Good evening. I'm opening this meeting of House Committee on Revenue Thursday, February 6th. Thank you all for your patience. We have two members absent, and we were basically we're trying to figure out what the situation is. Everything is fine. We're going to proceed with our hearing and our work session. I'm going to take the items not in the order in which the agenda lists them. We're doing a work session first. I anticipate that will not take too long, and then we will go to the public hearing. Someone's okay with that. I'm opening the work session on House Bill 4079.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4079 with the dash one is the what's become known as the broadband bill. This would establish broadband fund and would adjust rates on the OUSF that are currently set at 8.5% and bring them down to 6% and broaden the base to cover more than just wireline providers, all telecom providers. And this would essentially take allow the PUC to transfer monies in excess of the obligated monies from the OUSF, lesser $5 million or the excess revenues to the broadband fund. And then this program would sunset in 2030.
Thank you. Chair is ready to have a motion if anyone on the committee is interested.
I'll do that. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Chair Nathanson, I move the dash one amendment be adopted into House Bill 4079.
Representative Marsh moves the dash one amendment into House Bill 4079. Any discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 4079 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh has moved House Bill 4079 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Rush.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be a no on this. I just see after the CAT tax and the SAC tax, now we're going to add a cell phone tax, and I'm just I just think we're taxing ourselves to prosperity, and I'm just going to say no.
Yes.
Chair, I too will also be a no, and I do live in District 60, which is the biggest underserved area that a lot of this money would go to support. I do believe we need to find someplace in the general fund to help with match on the USDA rural development grants for broadband. I do also have an opinion that we are taxing ourselves too much, and that this is a tax that won't actually affect change. Broadband is a more complex situation than just putting the fiber in. Once you get the fiber in, you gotta light it up. You gotta have a private industry that'll actually supply that to the rural areas, and I'm not sure we've got that figured out. So it will be a no vote.
Thank you for your comments. I will note that this is described on our agenda. There's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Someone had asked me about that. Any other comments? The objections are two. I think let's do a roll call.
That'd be great.
Please.
Rep. Hernandez, Rep. Kennedy Iyer.
Aye.
Rep. Holmes.
Nay.
Rep. Smith. Vice Chair Marsh.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
No.
Chair Nathanson.
Aye.
The ayes have it. The motion passes. The carrier will be Representative Marsh. Thank you. We've completed all the necessary actions for House Bill 4079. I'm closing the work session. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 4010.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill
4010, talks about effectively disconnecting from the Federal Opportunity Zone Program at the state level. There is a dash one amendment, and that amendment, the effect of that amendment when combined with the intro version, it disconnects from every benefit under the program at the state level from year 2020 on, and there's some clarifying language that LC thought would be a little bit clearer.
I think we're going to go, well, did you want to do some presentation? I don't think we need it.
Okay.
This committee has had a very full presentation on opportunity zones from Legislative Revenue Office. In the interest of making sure we hear your testimony in this public hearing, we're not going to repeat some of the briefing material that we've already received. So while I look at the rest of the list of people who've signed up to testify, I'd like to call up Representative David Brock-Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Mars, Vice Chair Reschke, State Representative David Brock-Smith. House District 1, which encompasses everything from Charleston around Coos Bay down 101 on the coast to Brookings Harbor over to West Cape Junction, up West I-5 to West Roseburg, and then back over to the coast and all the wonderful communities in between, which include a number of opportunity zones. Because as you can imagine, we have some pretty impoverished communities there, including my home community. Of Port Orford and the census tract that was chosen there by the governor when she chose the 86 for the state. And that community, as I've testified to you on the House floor, had one of the most impoverished school districts in the nation just a few years ago. And so I just want to talk to you about the importance. I don't need to get into the nuts and bolts on how the opportunity zones work, because of course you've received that material. But the tax dollars that are going to be associated with development within these opportunity zones that fund our schools, that fund our public safety, we have 42 taxing districts in Curry County alone, for example. Our libraries survive on those tax dollars. Our volunteer fire department survive on those tax dollars that are going to benefit from the development of the opportunity zone. In my district, the major project is about a $60, $65 million golf course that is going to be going in. That's only about 32 miles south of the Bandon Dunes golf courses that are there just north of Bandon. And the jobs that are associated with these opportunity zone projects bring resources to these impoverished communities. I understand that there could be some frustration with a few of these opportunity zones and where they were sited because of the census tracts that were eligible in the process. But even then, in the Pearl District of Portland, it was designated an impoverished community. We talk about impoverished Oregon as not just rural, but as also urban. And those situations and those jobs associated with them and the tax dollars to fund those school systems and those public safety services and so on and so forth would benefit Portland just as much if it would benefit Port Orford. But let me put something in perspective. The $10 million project, the $60 million project that we're doing down on the South Coast is equivalent to probably a $300 million project that you're doing in Portland, right? Because of the ratio of poverty and the number of jobs that are going to be created. And so with that one project that's moving forward, there's going to be ancillary businesses that are going to also occur and be started, such as linen services and new hotels and so on and so forth. And all kinds of, there's all kinds of other ideas for employment opportunities for communities, not just in Port Orford, but surrounding my community back home. I can tell you that without this program, that project will not occur, because those tax incentives is what is going to fund this project. And so I urge you, please, to not move this bill forward, and let's invest in Oregon. I understand that there's some controversy over some of those investment opportunities, but I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of those opportunity zones in the state will benefit these impoverished communities, their residents, and the local economies, as well as the public services through the tax dollars associated with the development. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, yeah, just a quick question. You're very passionate about economic development in your community. You come up with a lot of ideas. I wonder if you are at all excited about the second part of the bill that talks about taking a strong look at more targeted investments, not having to follow exactly the same guidelines as opportunity zones, but looking at what we might do in Oregon, the kinds of things we might invest in, and how would we best do that. Have you looked at that part of the bill?
I have looked at it. I'm always in favor of trying to find some sort of investment opportunities for economic development for rural, for Oregon in general, but also for our rural districts. I wouldn't want to stop something that we have already in place, that people are already putting resources in funding through the opportunity funds that fund the projects in the zones. And it's like we're here at the 11th hour as those 10-year, you know, investments are moving forward, and Oregon's going to say, well, actually, we're going to take Route 97 and we're going to go and do something else. We don't know what that is yet, so we still want you to invest, but we're going to go ahead try to form something else for Oregon specific.
Okay, can I ask a question to you, Madam Chair? I think the investments that we've made still have to be honored through the 10 years, is that right?
This is a public hearing. I don't want to get into the technical stuff.
Okay.
I want to make sure really that we have time to hear from everyone, and I will ask LRO to respond to that after the public hearing. Good question.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Not yet.
Okay.
But would you like one?
I would like one.
Yes. We're going to be at, if you don't mind, I'm going to be at ease.
That's fine.
We're going to stand at ease for a few minutes.
Are you going to go out for a drink after this?
Thank you for your patience. We're still trying to work out a few procedural things because we have members absent. One may be en route, I'm not quite sure, and the other we still haven't located. But anyway, we're going to resume the public hearing at this time. Representative Brock Smith has probably left the room by now. Is that right? So we're going to continue with testimony for the public hearing. Next, I would like to hear, we're going to go sort of back and forth. That was against. We're going to hear a for, then we'll hear some against, you know, back and forth like that. So next, I'd like to hear Bennett Minton, John Calhoun, Laurie Wimmer.
Madam Chair, we're missing one of our suspects, so we'll... Oh, he's back. I'm sorry.
So just start as quickly as you can. After that panel, we will have Cadence Petros, Sarah Zahn, Eric Payne. I hope I said the names right. That will be the next panel after this one.
Well, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, Thank you. I'm Bennett Minton, and I'm here on behalf of a coalition of members, if I can get this device to work. There we are. There you see our logos, and there's a list of us. It's submitted for the record. I'm not going to read them. We support disconnection, and there are a number of points we'd like to make in our presentation. We see it as a device for avoiding capital gains taxes. That benefits are only available for a small slice of the state, some of which are questionable. That the cost is unknown, but we know it's in the millions of dollars. That Oregonians needn't invest here in order to get Oregon tax breaks. And we think it's another example of a system that is not fair. Opportunity zones were designed by Congress and intended for areas that already have mutually reinforcing state, local, and private economic development initiatives and have already demonstrated success. And I want to pause here and say, I've seen this movie because before I moved to Oregon and stopped shaving, I was a tax analyst and lobbyist and reporter in Washington starting in 1986. Jack Kemp was HUD secretary when he came to Capitol Hill and argued passionately for then what were called enterprise zones. I was at the 1992 Republican convention when he brought a bunch of former linemen from the Buffalo Bills who used to guard him when he was playing quarterback to demonstrate that his heart was in the right place. And I know that his heart was in the right place. But studies since then on both right and left have indicated that these kinds of tax programs are really great for investors, but they don't do anything for distressed communities. Opportunity funds, as you know, are privately managed financing vehicles for projects and opportunity zones, and as we say, they are a device for reducing taxes on investors. They work by allowing a taxpayer to sell a capital asset and invest in projects in opportunity zones. By doing so, they defer the tax on their gain until 2026, at which time they have a reduction in the tax they would owe. And their new investments in the opportunity zones are tax-free after 10 years. So for example, I have $1 million gain. I defer $337,000 in federal and state taxes. In 2026, I get a $50,000 reduction, and my O fund investments pay zero tax after 10 years, so it works kind of like a Roth 401k. The people who benefit from this have unrealized capital gains. If you don't have capital gains, then you can't play. That's not who this is for. Because of that, you want the investors are looking for high margin projects, and they foresee selling their fund shares in a decade. So whose idea was this? An unlikely group of billionaires and politicians has created the most unbelievable tax break ever, said Forbes of all magazines 2 years ago. And Sean Parker was the guy behind it. He's the first president of Facebook. He founded Napster before that. He's been traveling around the country speaking to Treasury-sponsored investor conferences. And as he says, when you're a founder of Facebook and you own a lot of stock, you spend a lot of time thinking about capital gains. So what did he do? He got together with some of his high-tech buddies and some others in real estate, and he went to D.C. and he started a think tank called the Economic Innovation Group. He spent $3 million over 3 years to lobby Congress, and in 2017, behold, the opportunity for opportunities fell into their lap and it dropped into the 2017 tax bill. The cost to the federal treasury, joint tax estimated at the time, was about $1.5 billion a year through 2026, at which time there would be a rush of revenue back into the treasury when the deferral period ended. And then after that, the losses would accelerate. But as you see, we don't know what happens in 2028 because joint tax doesn't do revenue estimates beyond 10 years. And what we do know is that is exactly when the third benefit kicks in. So what was a trickle turns into a rush. Joint Tax looked again at the cost in December and found that it had more than doubled to $3.5 billion a year. And of course, they're only doing five-year estimates, so we don't know. But we've gone from a $12 billion loss over 10 to 16.9 over 5.
So what would happen if
Oregon withdrew from state tax benefits? Well, then we'd be like California and Washington and Nevada. Washington and Nevada, along with these other gray states, don't have an income tax, so they don't offer this benefit in the first place. California is a non-conforming state, so it was never connected in the first place. The same is true in Mississippi and Massachusetts. North Carolina disconnected as soon as they got the opportunity in May of 2018. So I'll turn it over to John.
Vice Chair Marsh, members of the committee, my name is John Calhoun. This program has been sold as a creative way to bring investments to distressed communities seeking revitalization. But as Bennett pointed out, this program also targets the areas that are already getting investments. Major funds tout investments in great properties that made sense without the added tax benefits as seen by the quote on the screen. Crescent Capital, which is raising $53 million for a 24-story luxury apartment building in Portland, promotes that it will be located in the number one qualified opportunity zone tract in the country, downtown Portland. Crescent has raised another $450 million for a fund with multiple investments around the country. The big money is going into investments like the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Portland, which will have the highest room rates in the city and condos selling for millions. Despite publicity about this being a program for distressed communities or small towns, the preponderance of the capital will go to thriving urban areas, not small town Oregon. I'm not saying there won't be some, but that's not where the preponderance of the income will go or the investment will go. Some proponents of Opportunity Zones claim this tax break on profits will create a market for investments that are otherwise not going to happen. But from the investor's perspective, to get this tax benefit, he has to put his money into a project with a pretty good profitability to begin with, and one that can be sold in 10 years for more than he invested it. Otherwise, there are no capital gains and therefore no tax benefit. 10 years is a long time during which you cannot sell your asset. A lot can and often does change. So unless you take the approach of Crescent Capital that you only invest in projects that you expect will have a strong return before the tax incentive, you are taking on an inherent and unnecessary risk. Investors are always considering alternative ways to invest. The stock market is the primary alternative since it provides instant liquidity, diversification, and over the long term, a 7-10% return. That means that riskier real estate generally needs a higher returns, and in fact, expected real estate returns over time are in the 10-12% range. The national funds are promoting a 10% annual pre-tax return. Hundreds of these funds are aggressively selling across the country. I get an email or see online ads almost every day from one of them. I had a conversation a few weeks ago with one of your legislative colleagues, and this legislator told me that he was discussing retirement options with a financial advisor, and the advisor tried to sell him on a national opportunity zone, illustrating the reach of these funds. What this means is that cities like Burns, Klamath Falls, and Hermiston are not just competing with Portland for investments by Oregonians, but also Seattle, Houston, Atlanta, Denver, and every other hot growth area in the country. It also means that investing in workforce housing at an expected return of 3-4% in distressed areas of Oregon is not an attractive alternative for most investors, even if the eventual sale of the property is tax-free. Capital will generally flow to investments with the highest returns and the lowest risk. The New York Times interviewed an Oregon entrepreneur, Mr. Paul DeMaray, that sold his business here, but invested not in the local opportunity zone, but one in North Carolina and one in Arizona. If we do not pass HB 4010, we will reward his investments in the other states with a reduction in Oregon taxes. We lose revenue for his children's schools, but other states get the investment. Why should we do this? We believe that under current law, the majority of the Oregon revenue loss will come from investments in the other 49 states, not in Oregon, because of the sales and marketing power of these national funds and just the range of opportunities. Meanwhile, investors in other states will continue to invest in Oregon because these same funds are not promoting state tax reductions, just the federal ones. We'd be happy to participate in the study group to see if this or another approach is the best way to support low-income or workforce housing across the state.
Good evening, Madam Vice Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, and it's my honor to join this panel today in support of House Bill 4010. We believe that remaining connected to the federal law granting what I call opportunistic tax zones to wealthy investors reflects the wrong arrangements of priorities for Oregon. And now for my part in this panel presentation. You have the power to stop subsidizing the tiny fraction of taxpayers who have reportable capital gains and to stop subsidies for the 86 of Oregon's 834 census tracts. The ultimate effects of these incentives are still unknown, but we do know that luxury high-rises are going up in downtown Portland. These are projects that would have been built irrespective of the tax breaks because they would be profitable for wealthy investors. That taxpayers are shouldering more of the load so that these investors get a subsidy is simply unconscionable. Oregonians desperately need affordable housing and remedies for houselessness. We have the highest rate of unhoused youth in the nation. These subsidies do nothing for our most pressing problems. Instead, they will finance condos priced at $6 million at the Ritz-Carlton. Legislators in other parts of Oregon may hope that the federal and state subsidies will be deposited in their backyards, but nothing about this program suggests that this will happen, as you've heard. Salem has no control over where the market chooses to invest. Thus, it cannot be said with a straight face that this program provides a stimulus value that will improve Oregon's economy. And in fact, there is no requirement to mitigate blight. There is no requirement to create jobs at prevailing wage levels. There is no requirement that Oregon-based investors put their money in Oregon projects. Oregon's education workforce would like you to consider their students first, who come to school hungry, homeless, and hurting. Our service supports have thankfully been improved by last year's passage of the Student Success Act, but there's so much more we need to do on the human services front. Giveaways such as this program fly in the face of fairness and basic humanity as Oregon's income inequality gap continues to widen. We join a growing chorus of voices that are asking you to become the 14th state to disconnect so that Oregonians no longer lavish opportunity zones with state tax subsidies. Maryland is vying to beat you to the punch because yesterday their tax committee heard a similar bill. To close, consider what the Cato Institute said about this program. Its director of tax policy studies, the other Chris Edwards, has long been on the warpath against opportunity zones, and he wrote, "Ozones are a bad idea and should be repealed. They actively divide the nation between winner and loser communities. They replace equal justice under law with differential treatment based on political poll. The main winners likely are landowners within the zones, not poor households. We urge you to pass 4010, excuse me. Thank you very much."
Thank you. Any questions? All right, we'll call up the next panel, and that would be James Petros, Sarah Zahn, Eric Payne. We are going to encourage you to keep your comments to 3 minutes. We'll set a timer so that you know when you reach your max. Please
Thank
begin.
You. Vice Chair Marsh, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cadence Petros, Development Division Manager for the City of Beaverton. In my role at Beaverton, I am responsible for managing affordable housing as well as revitalization activities for the city. Thank you for this opportunity to share our concerns with HB 4010 as introduced, which would disconnect Oregon from the Federal Opportunity Zone program. Beaverton is currently focused on an opportunity zone in central Beaverton that has experienced high levels of poverty and blighted properties. In 2017, nearly 18% of residents, including 24% of children, were living in poverty, figures that exceed the state and Portland's MSA averages. Median family income in this area was also 41% below the metro area average. The city has made significant investments to support and grow entrepreneurship in Central Beaverton. Beaverton is a founding partner of the Oregon Technology Business Center, a nonprofit located in Central Beaverton that helps startups become thriving businesses. Of the 25 companies chosen through OTBC's Beaverton Startup Challenge, 14 of the 25 founders are underserved entrepreneurs, 7 women, 7 people of color, and 1 veteran. The city also uses general funds and community development block grant funding to support nonprofit organizations that provide microenterprise support for communities of color and disadvantaged populations within the Central Beaverton Opportunity Zone. Now, the city is actively marketing its Central Beaverton Opportunity Zone to generate strategic private investments in a proposed arts and innovation district that will complement the city's existing business incubator and entrepreneurship programs, urban renewal activities, and other place-based investments. In December 2019, the city selected Oregon-based urban development partners to develop a 2-acre site owned by our urban renewal agency and located in the heart of Beaverton Opportunity Zone. The site, known as BC2, is adjacent to Max Light Rail and the now under construction Patricia Resource Center for the Arts. The $86 million proposed development plan, which will be funded through an Urban Opportunity Fund, calls for 150,000 square feet of creative office space. This is the first speculative Class A office space to be constructed in 20 years in the city of Beaverton. And 30,000 square feet of ground floor retail and restaurants to activate sidewalks and street frontages, making the site a more walkable, vibrant community space. The buildings also include 17,000 square feet of innovation spaces designed to house a variety of small tenants needing affordable and flexible performance, innovative startup, and maker space. It targets a diverse array of businesses and organizations in all stages of the business lifecycle, including startups, co-located facilities, and inclusive artist support. The BC2 project is a type of public-private development that would likely not occur without the full benefits of Opportunity Zone, both federal and state. It's perfectly tailored to leverage the city's entrepreneurship and revitalization efforts. We believe this bill will add uncertainty to the Opportunity Zone program, which may discourage Oregon taxpayers from making the kind of transformative investments that are happening in Central Beaverton. We urge the committee not to move this bill. Thank you again for the opportunity to share our opposition to HB 4010. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Reske, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Zahn, and I'm Development Director for Urban Development Partners, a real estate development and investment management firm based in Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns this afternoon about HB 4010. Over my 15 years in development, I've worked on projects encompassing mixed-use infill, multifamily, office, higher education, civic uses, and affordable housing, mostly in Oregon. In October 2019, Urban Development Partners responded to an RFP by the City of Beaverton for redevelopment of a 2-acre property within an opportunity zone. The city wanted bold ideas that would create more jobs and grow small businesses and leverage significant prior public investments in transit and public infrastructure. As you heard from Cadence, our proposal represents a bold investment in the future of Beaverton as a center for jobs, innovation, and the arts. Urban Development Partners is expecting to raise approximately $40 million in equity in support of this project. A significant portion, 90% of that equity, will come through investments in our Opportunity Zone Fund. This proprietary fund, which we raise to deploy in support of projects which we develop and manage, is made up of mostly individual investors. More than 50% of them live in Oregon, and the average individual investment is less than $500,000. They are small business owners, physicians, technology entrepreneurs, solar energy innovators, and even farmers. They choose to invest with UDP because we are doing projects in their communities and in Oregon with a focus on sustainability, fostering community, and creating economic opportunity. If these investors did not have access to our Opportunity Zone Fund, they might take their investment dollars elsewhere, or they may not invest at all. In many cases, we're working with investors who are property owners. Opportunity zone funds give these investors a reasonable alternative and actually generate capital gains tax revenue to the state. As you know, OZ investors will pay 90% of their initial capital gains owed after 7 years. These may otherwise be locked up in long-term in real estate, often spanning generations. Disconnecting would negatively impact investing in Oregon's opportunity zones. It sends a signal to those looking to unleash new investment in communities across Oregon to go elsewhere. Another important point is how the opportunity zone encourages developers and their investors to remain as long-term stakeholders within the community. This was a critical point for Beaverton as part of our proposal. In our short-term-minded world, getting investors to commit to 10-plus-year timeframes is very difficult, and the current Opportunity Zone Fund helps all of Oregon get that long-term investment, ensuring developers and investors have a long-term stake in the health and vitality of the communities where they work. Vice Chair Reske and members of the committee.
It's going this direction.
Well, thanks.
You're going to be here on your own. Leave it to the new guy.
Yeah. I urge you to drop any consideration of disconnecting Oregon from the Opportunity Zone. It's just the beginning to produce the community investment it was designed for. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Good evening, Vice Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for having us. My name is Eric Payne, CEO of Community Development Partners. We're a mission-driven organization that develops and operates low-income housing, so across the spectrum of different affordable housing developments. And we're working both in urban and rural areas, in Portland and down Valley, in LeGrand, in St. Helens, in Tigard. And I thought maybe I could offer a different point of view as someone that's spent the last 2 years trying to figure out what exactly opportunity zones were and how they could be utilized and if there was a potential to kind of marry those with existing resources that were being provided at the state level to leverage existing state resources to go further for our affordable housing projects. And I mean, in this time where we have limited resources to develop affordable housing, at least relative to the demand, and all of the sources are typically oversubscribed, any tool that we can rely on to stretch those dollars and get these projects to the finish line, this is critical. So one project is called Rockwood 10 that we worked on, and we closed the financing in December. I've been working on it for 3 years. It's 224 units, 100% affordable housing in the Rockwood neighborhood of Gresham. We're co-developing that with Hacienda, CDC. Project had overwhelming amount of support, but there would have been a funding gap if the project hadn't been structured financially using Opportunity Zone. We brought to the table a key bank as their community banking group, and then some of our own capital gains that we had made, and we decided because of opportunity zones that we would like to see those redeployed into a mission-driven project here in Oregon. So we structured our own kind of small fund and then also brought Key Bank in, and because of that, we needed significantly less resources from the state. We had a small amount of gap funding from the state, but without the opportunity zone structure, the project wouldn't have come to fruition without us coming back to either the state or another jurisdiction asking for the capital. I think that's the cost versus the impact, at least on our specific project and probably others like it that our meeting what the intention was in serving the low-income communities and providing housing and jobs. It seems like the cost versus the budgetary impact would favor the side of keeping the opportunity zone coupled with the federal tax code. So we're in support of that, and at a minimum of not pulling the plug when there's projects that have already been structured and funded using opportunity zones. The way the bill's currently contemplated, the deferral would still be there, but roughly 50% of the benefits would be yanked away from projects that have already been funded under the code. So we'd recommend that there's ample time to take and assess projects that are actually being done and check into the impacts of those before actually pulling the plug and then doing a study. That seems like the reverse order. But thanks for hearing us out. If you have any questions, let me know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I came in late, so the two of you talked about projects. I'm curious how many jobs those have created. And if you talked about it, the lady on the far left there talked mm-hmm. about that as well. I'd like to know how many jobs these projects would have created.
So if the UDP project moves forward, we are estimating about 800 jobs.
Okay. And how about the
project? You know, the nature of our project being housing is the majority of the jobs would be temporary construction jobs, but obviously it's a significant $60 million project.
And how many jobs are sustained then? How's that for?
Yeah, and probably 15. Full-time.
15 full-time.
Yeah, yeah. It's smaller, but it's 224 units of housing.
Thank you.
Okay, we're ready to move to the next panel. Jody Weiser and Josie.
Jody Weiser, Josie, and Avery.
After that, we will have J.L. Wilson and Jonathan McGuire.
So, I'll go first. On behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, I simply want to make one point. One of our members, who is herself an accredited investor, so she could invest in any of these funds, made phone calls to 12 opportunity funds. Some of them were in Oregon, and some of them were elsewhere in the country. She looked into funds for a single building and ones for a group of buildings. She looked for ones that purported to serve community needs and ones that seemed to be focused totally on profitability and return to investors.
Before you say too much more, would you please state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Jody Weiser.
Thank you.
In talking to the 12 different funds in Oregon and around the country, she did not have a single company fund person raised the issue of state taxes. She'd been clear that she lived in a state that has income taxes, but every one of them talked only about federal tax breaks. Not one brought up state taxation. And so she would raise the issue, and she said each time she did, there was a long pause. It's like it's a question that had never occurred to them. I would leave the pause, but they only know how to talk about federal tax breaks. That's all they're relying on. That was her experience. And in my testimony, there's one of the pieces that is actually used by quite a few different groups to show how does an investment in an opportunity zone compare to a standard real estate investment? And it shows that there's about twice as much profit on the bottom line if they each have the same kind of annual gains and stuff. But you'll see in red that when they talk about less the capital gains tax, they talk about 23.8%. That's the federal capital gains tax. That's not anything about the state capital gains tax. So that it is not really part of what they've been using to sell investors on making investments. The critical factors on state tax issues is also the residency of the investor, not where the investment is. If you make an investment in Oregon, you pay Oregon capital gains tax as part of your income tax. But if you make an investment in New York, you also pay taxes in Oregon on your capital gains tax in the other state. There are situations where there are different ways to organize your business ownership. So you might, in some cases, be taxed in two states, but any tax you had paid in that example in New York would be subtracted from what you owe in Oregon. So we think, actually, it is time for states to chart their own course and make their own decisions about our tax structure rather than having our decisions dictated by Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Josie, you're next. Okay.
I'll try to be fast here. Chair Nathanson, members of the House Committee on Revenue. My name is Josie Kerner, and I am representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon and serving as a member on the Opportunity Zone Disconnect Coalition. One of the key areas that the League legislative action team has prioritized for the 2020 session is to generate adequate revenue for essential services while promoting equity and progressivity in tax policy. The League supports a tax system that is based on the ability to pay, but applies a benefits received principle wherever reasonable and that recognizes the role of social expediency. We do not believe the Opportunity Zone capital gains tax break for investments align with these goals of equity and progressivity. The League of Oregon supports HB 4010 because it will prevent a potentially large loss of Oregon state revenue due to the state's present default connection to the federal Oregon tax Opportunity Zone break. This will prohibit these capital gains deductions on the Oregon tax return. The purported intent of the Opportunity Zone program is to spur private capital investments in underinvested, economically distressed communities. In practice, however, the projects underway or planned under this program are often, obviously not always, high return investments located in prime real estate areas. The federal program has very broad parameters defining low-income areas based on large census tract data that are easy to exploit to investor advantage. One of the League of Women Voters' objections to this program is that the federal program was designed by wealthy investors to reduce or avoid capital gains on stock or real estate that those investors would otherwise be required to pay. If Oregon offers an additional state tax gains break, Oregon will lose a valuable source of revenue to support its public services, even on investments Oregon investors make outside of Oregon. Is there a case to be made that the investment will be of social benefit? We think not usually. This is clearly a benefit for wealthy investors at the expense of the very people the incentive was supposed to benefit. Qualified opportunity zones are open to accredited investors with either $1 million in net assets, excluding the value of a primary home, or $200,000 in annual income, or with a wife, it's $300,000, and for each several years running and expected going forward. So these are wealthy folks. The projected high rate of return is what attracts these investors in the first place, and they can go anywhere in the country to do this. That it's the fund managers who decide on the investment projects, not the state or local government. So they're offering very high rates of return and
of a closing sentence.
I do.
Okay. With the fast-growing economic inequality, an increase in homelessness, and lack of affordable housing in Oregon, why would Oregon choose to forgo Oregon revenue for yet another tax break for the wealthy who are the most able to afford it? We need tax policies that actually reduce inequality, not exacerbate the problem. Although Oregon can do nothing about the federal opportunity tax break, Oregon can take the steps that HB 4010 offers to protect Oregon revenues by decoupling Oregon taxes from the federal and to study if there's ways to direct these investments to the economically distressed communities the incentive was meant to help. We hope you will pass this bill. Thank you for the opportunity.
Jody and Josie, you can be excused from the table. And while Avery stays, JL and Jonathan White can come on up. And Avery can start.
Thank you. Good evening. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee. My name is Avery Pickard. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Economic Development Association. It's the statewide group for bringing together the economic development community, those folks that are working on the ground in Oregon communities to do economic development and use all the tools in their toolbox to do that. OEDA opposes House Bill 4010. Oregon's opportunity zones, all 86 of them, are largely located in rural areas, and they help to stimulate economic development by encouraging long-term investment in these communities. Our member communities that are plugged in with OIDA, receiving significant interest in reinvesting local capital in their community, capital that they can attest would otherwise remain in other investments or deployed to other assets or other states. Projects and opportunity zones address a range of community uplift objectives, from job-creating projects to housing development. All project types bring community benefit and property tax revenue. Disconnecting from federal code will penalize Oregon investors by treating them differently, denying Oregonians seeking to deploy capital locally the same benefits as those who invest elsewhere and as out-of-state investors. Disconnection will create complexity and confusion, but it does not eliminate opportunity zones in Oregon. It just compromises the eligibility of Oregon taxpayers to realize the capital gains incentives in future years for Oregon investment. At the same time that out-of-state taxpayers or corporations can still receive that benefit. At best, this will lead to out-of-state ownership and control of Oregon assets. At worst, it means no investments in the communities that need it most. I've included in our submission some illuminating comment from our member communities and signatory support. These communities share in our message, and they want you to know what the tool has meant for their communities. LeGrand, Albany, McMinnville, Klamath, Redmond, among many others. I hope that you'll read what they have to say. Oregon, in the broader context of economic development, has such a limited toolbox with which to practice successful economic development that our feeling is by diminishing the value of this incentive, the bill would discourage local investment and isolate Oregon from key capital markets at a time when Oregon communities are desperately seeking to spur interest that breathes life and promise into these communities. We urge you to vote no on the bill and reject the decoupling of Oregon's opportunity zones from the federal program. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Jonathan McGuire, and I am the lead of the Qualified Opportunity Zone practice at Aldrich CPAs and Advisors. My full testimony has been provided, and also I'm here on behalf of Connie Rathbone and Stephen Brooks, who have also submitted a large testimony. Many of my colleagues, clients, and so on are very alarmed by the potential disconnect of federal Opportunity Zone legislation. One of the number one issues that we see primarily for those concerned with losing tax revenue is actually a lack of the understanding of the dollars that are going to be utilized for their taxability. So historically, taxpayers are going to use basis step-ups at the date of death, as well as a 1031 exchange to continue to defer and allow for tax-free realization on the sale of assets. And so unless that cash is needed throughout their lifetime, they're going to hold those stock investments or trade them through 1031 exchange. And all throughout that time, there's not going to be a taxable event. So right now, there's $6 to $7 trillion nationwide that is pent up in these capital gains. So really what they want to do here is pass all their wealth to their heirs. And yes, the estate tax will apply to that. So that's kind of the coming full circle to make sure that there is a taxable event. But what the Opportunity Zone program does is it's an attempt to unlock those capital gains now, today, so the federal government and as well as state governments can actually have an increase in the revenue. Yes, it's deferred until 2026, but over time you're going to get this taxable event that takes place on dollars, on stock, on real estate that otherwise would not be sold. People are not going to sell these unless for the Opportunity Zone program. In doing so, the other parts of this too are, you know, with the operation of funds, these funds are actually going to throw off ordinary income. They're going to create additional tax revenue year over year. So just by creating economic development, by spending this $1 that's been saved forever, it's going to move through the economy multiple times. And as it moves through that economy, it's going to create multiple taxable transactions. So in effect, by allowing opportunity zones to exist, you're going to potentially see up to 6 or 7 times that dollar moving through the economy, thus having 6 or 7 taxable transactions. So effectively, that $1 is going to be taxed at 70% at the highest 9.9% tax rate. So yes, investors are getting tax breaks, but they are taking a higher risk profile based upon the areas that they're investing in. These investors are going to make money regardless, and typically the investor is worried about profit, but also a lot of Oregon investors are worried about triple bottom line, where they're investing in both the economic, the social, and the environmental impact. So what I urge you to do is oppose this bill, because one, it's going to allow you to eliminate the housing crisis and unlock the full economic potential in Oregon. Thank you.
Good evening. Chair Nathanson, members for the record, J.L. Wilson representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce, Oregon's network of 84 chambers of commerce with professional staff. We oppose House Bill 4010. Typically, we support the Opportunity Zone program, and we believe in its efficacy because it is a tax incentive program that's actually tied to actual investment in our communities. And what we've seen that is bringing money in from the sidelines that otherwise wouldn't be there to invest in our local communities. And we've heard clearly from communities from LeGrand, our chambers in LeGrand and Curry County and Coos County and Redmond, Albany. I mean, this money and these programs are being put into use in communities all over the state, not just downtown Portland. And it often, we've heard particularly with the housing programs or the housing projects, that it requires both the federal and the state deferral of these taxes to make them pencil out. For our view, this seems to be a bill with very little upside. There are so many avenues today to shelter gains, capital gains, that it's hard to imagine that the state would actually realize any revenue from this bill. But we do believe the bill is rife with downside, particularly for a foregone investment in housing, because workforce housing really is the crisis of the business community, and this is the most viable tool we see today to deal with that. It's foregone business opportunity, it's foregone property tax base expansion, it's foregone income tax revenue from jobs and businesses. So we do ask the committee not to move forward with the bill.
Next, we will hear from Neil Amundson, Matthew Conser, Jason Orme. After that, it will be Marcia Kelly and Britt Conroy. Planning dinner.
I'll go first. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Neil Amundson. I live in Redmond, Oregon, and I have to empathize with each of you. I'm a recovering legislator myself from Washington State. I was involved in the Growth Management Act issues and understand what you deal with every day. It's a constant balance between having sufficient funds to do what you need to do in these various communities, but I have to say this. Similar to Oregon, in Washington, we have 39 counties. Without a doubt, 3 counties always make it through. 36 counties, in our case, always suffer. And I can share with you, and I hate to go against the wishes of the committee chair, but I would share with you, this bill will be a killer to economic incentives and development in rural communities and counties. It just will. And I'll give you examples for that. We currently have 2 projects going on in Opportunity Zones, one in McMinnville, and one in Redmond, Oregon. Both of those require significant investment. They're going to be over $30 million each. They will provide hundreds of jobs in that, not only the trades that will be used in building those developments, but then the surrounding businesses that come after that. The situation is, however, we need workforce housing. And we're not getting workforce housing, and there is not sufficient workforce housing or funding for workforce housing to come into some of these communities. In Redmond alone, we went out to 40 different banks across the nation to find investment to come into Redmond. We have not found a bank that will invest in Redmond, Oregon, because it's outside of the metro market. Your bill is, I think, well-focused for many of the urban areas and I agree. The example that is being used in downtown Portland is absurd. When I saw that come up, I thought that's a opposite of what this legislation was meant for. It's not meant for that. This legislation and this program was initiated under the Obama administration. It was for the purpose of bringing economic incentives to rural America, and that's its goal. I have traveled in, I believe, 8 different states in the Western U.S. looking for opportunities for Opportunity Zones. There's not that many opportunities, good opportunities, where income levels as well as rent levels will support that. And these subsidies for tax incentives are absolutely what's necessary for bringing investors to come in, invest like states like Oregon. So I share with you that we do and are committed to providing workforce housing in the communities into some of these rural areas. But I'll share with you that if you focus on the urban areas first, I think you'll take care of a great deal of the problem, but your rural counties will suffer most under this legislation. And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I would ask you to not pursue this legislation further. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good evening. I'm Matthew J. Conser. I'm a sixth-generation Oregonian. My great-great-great-grandfather, Jacob Conser, founded Jefferson, Oregon, just south of here on the St. Anne River in 1848. In the 1800s, the federal government offered him an opportunity to own and develop land in Oregon. That program granted him a donation land claim, on which he proceeded to develop the town of Jefferson, Oregon. From that, he built the first railroad addition to the city of Jefferson. He built the first ferry across the St. Anne River, the first city streets, the first modern homes. That wide spot in the road became a city, an organized place for commerce, government, schools for children, houses of worship, etc. He was a risk taker. And he invested here in Oregon, in his own backyard. Our family business, Conser Homes, has been in the housing business for the last 2 generations. We too are risk takers. When in the manufactured home business, we delivered and installed about 1,000 manufactured homes to both rural and urban median income Oregon families. We've built over 500 single family homes for modest income families in Oregon in the Albany Corvallis area. And we currently build apartments for the average Oregonian. How does that all apply to this hearing today? The Qualified Opportunity Zone is a federal and state supported program which will allow us modern day Oregonians to invest in improved overlooked areas of our state. Areas which have been passed by, not seen investment or new infrastructure. With the help of this program, these many wide spots in the road throughout Oregon could see real streets, real structures, true improvement. Folks, we're in a housing crisis like we've never seen before. The government can't provide all the needed housing or solve the problem itself. The private sector, family businesses like ours, have been trying and can provide for the need. We've already built one apartment project in a qualified opportunity zone in Yamhill County. We have another pending in Linn County in a qualified opportunity zone. The cost of the land, construction, city fees, and the infrastructure needed barely make the Linn County project viable. The market rents with no government subsidy will barely support the cost to construct it. Beyond housing being very near and dear to the heart and soul of our small family business, the lasting benefit and the reason that Linn County project could make sense long term are the qualified opportunity zone benefits. With that, we'll be able to extend a significant arterial city street, make pedestrian connections that don't exist, and we can provide 132 homes for families, new energy efficient, safe apartment homes, which now don't exist. The qualified opportunity zone makes it viable. I urge you not to decouple from the qualified opportunity zone program. Shouldn't we be able to invest in our own backyard? Help us develop these overlooked wide spots in the road. Thank you.
Good evening, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Orme. I'm a certified public accountant, a tax partner with the firm of Talbot, Corvola, and Warwick, and been a tax practitioner for over 30 years. I am also past chair of the Oregon Society of CPAs. You have my written remarks. Read them. I will summarize. As a tax practitioner, my concern is and has always been complexity. You noticed on the map that was presented earlier this evening that the vast majority of states with an income tax are not decoupled from the federal tax, from the federal law. The reason for that is it puts taxpayer preparers and, more importantly, Oregon taxpayers in a difficult position, because now they have one more set of rules to figure out. The Oregon Department of Revenue deals with this issue as taxpayers doing their best make unintended errors on their returns because of the differences in rules. I remember the Tax Reform Act of 1986. It brought in some very complex law. Life has not changed much since then. In fact, it has become more and more complex. The Oregon Society of CPAs and its more than 4,400 members oppose this bill because it adds complexity to already complex law, which adversely affects Oregon taxpayers. We encourage a no vote on this bill. Thank you for your time. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? I have one comment. If any of you, either this panel or any other panels, had written material that you had not already submitted, if you would like to leave it or a copy of it with the staff at the desk before we leave tonight, we can include that in the record. Otherwise, we do have your comments recorded on the audio version. Thank you.
Thank you.
So it's Marcia and Britt, right? And then following that, Gwen Baldwin, Jeremy Rogers, Kevin Mannix. And that completes the list for tonight.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and I will also mention that I'm co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee, and we submitted written testimony, and I'd just like to call your attention to that. I'm a native of Central Oregon. I was born in Bend. My father worked in Redmond when before I was born, a long time ago. And I want to tell you a story about one of the Opportunity Zone projects in Redmond. It's the Redmond Hotel. It was built in 1928. It received historic registered designation in 1980, and it stopped having guests in 2005. It got sold to a purchaser in Bend. They had businesses in the hotel main floor, but no rental up above. In 2012, the City of Redmond Urban Renewal District did a study to see what the best possible use was for this site. It came up with the idea of a hotel. That progressed. The hotel still didn't change hands. And then it changed hands sometime between 2014 and 2017. I couldn't find out where. But in 2017, it's noted in their urban renewal that they had a prospect for developing the hotel, Alpha Wave Investments out of California. They were planning on closing in August. In 2017, in December, they had all of the documents ready and everybody had applied for everything. And this was done before the Opportunity Zone came about. Fast forward, 2018, they get tax credits, historic registered tax credits. They've got a loan, a forgivable loan from the City of Redmond and other investments. And then in 2019, they get opportunity tax zones too. So this hotel just opened. $107 a night, I think, is what they were going for last night. And it's a good thing for downtown Redmond. But did this project happen because of the opportunity zones when everything was in place before? I think not. I would like to challenge the CPA who talked about the complexity of taxpayers doing this. People who have capital gains tax, the percentage of people who have capital gains tax have a complex enough tax structure that they normally have someone else who does their taxes, or they do them themselves because they are. So I would like to challenge that because I think that that's a red herring.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Reschke, and members of the committee. My name is Britt Conroy, and I serve as Public Policy Director with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. EMO supports HB 4010 and the Dash 1 Amendment, its federal disconnect, and its creation of a study group to determine how opportunity zones could be used to truly build low-cost and workforce housing or improve the lives of Oregonians. EMO serves 17,000 low-income Oregonians in our state every year through 9 direct service programs. These individuals walk through our doors needing help and seeking hope. Our clients and hundreds of thousands of others in this state can tell you that the hardest job in Oregon is being poor. And it is doubly hard in the context of growing wealth disparity between those with tremendous means and the rest of our citizens. And in a moment when Oregon's lowest income quintile pay more of their income in taxes than our state's wealthiest 1%, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. The result of this disparity is that too many of our friends and neighbors find it difficult to pay the bills, feed their children, or avoid housing instability. This reality manifests itself in shameful national rankings and heartbreaking statistics. We have the highest rate of K-12 student homelessness in this country, and 1 in 9 Oregon households struggle to put food on the table. It is in this context that EMO approaches tonight's discussion on opportunity zones. As you have heard today, most of the opportunity zone investments here in Oregon are going into areas that have already seen considerable development in recent years. Moreover, the benefits are going to investors in developments that would have happened even if opportunity zone tax breaks at the state level were not available, putting in jeopardy resources needed to stand side by side with our struggling neighbors. These are not Oregon values. EMO supports the proposed disconnect and urges passage of HB 4010 and the Dash 1 Amendment. Thank you.
Questions? Next panel, Gwen Jeremy Kevin.
Being able to write comments?
I was trying to figure out where you
go. Okay, so post-staff logging. We have to do that first.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Jeremy Rogers on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. OAR, we're a 17,000 plus member association of residential and commercial realtors in Oregon, here today to oppose House Bill 2010 and ask you to reconsider your approach to this issue. We fully support the idea of wanting to understand the benefits of certain programs and investments that you're making, but we believe that pulling the rug out of under this program just as it's beginning really undermined its ability to achieve the benefits that we all want to see it achieve. And we're particularly interested in the benefits that it can achieve to create more housing across the state of Oregon. And I really encourage you to carefully consider the testimony that you see in the record and that you heard today from those directly involved in projects. And as you all know, piecing together a project to make it financially viable, particularly in a community that cannot draw as high of rents as you can in downtown Portland. And I know there's that example that's floating around, but the vast majority of the 86 zones are in economically distressed communities, and piecing together projects, particularly multifamily housing projects, that will pencil out given the rents that can be collected in those communities is very, very difficult. And that's why this legislature has spent the last several years and continues to spend a lot of time trying to piece together multiple tools to help achieve housing in the state. And it's a combination of incentives, of direct investments, of state and local government reconsidering their regulations and their zoning. I mean, the state's working on all of that. And here we have an opportunity that exists that was passed by the federal government but sort of put on our lap to create another one of those tools. And if you're talking about a community where rents are not that high, the additional, you know, an additional few percent of return that could come from this type of program and from the state portion of it could be the difference in a project happening or not. And it seems odd to me that we would want to pull the rug out of under that program before we've given it a chance to work. I mean, it's perfectly fair to take a look at the effectiveness of the program after it's existed and make tweaks to it if it's not achieving the results we want. But to pull the plug now and then evaluate, it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, what are we going to be evaluating? You know, you can't evaluate something that doesn't exist. And right now, the momentum is just getting going. I mean, the rules that the federal government, the final rules, were just published a couple of months ago. And now we're talking about getting rid of this. So I just think it's a terrible idea, given all the other things we're doing and the layering of tools and incentives we're creating around housing. Let's give this a shot, and then let's take a look at it after that. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Reschke, members of the committee. My name is Gwen Baldwin. I'm here this evening representing Oregon Smart Growth, a coalition of developers, investors, and allied professions committed to feasible development of walkable, livable communities that are environmentally, socially, and economically sustainable. We oppose House Bill 4010 because it disconnects Oregon from the Federal Opportunity Zone program. And regardless of how one feels about the federal policy, the effect of this bill will be to disadvantage Oregon investors and Oregon communities across the state. As you've heard before, there are 86 zones across Oregon. They were selected by the governor's office and Business Oregon to bring investment dollars into communities in specific low-income census tracts where there is both an opportunity to leverage existing attributes and strengthen the local economy. In fact, Oregon was lauded by Smart Growth America for its process in selecting its opportunity zones so that they have a higher chance of delivering positive economic, environmental, and social returns. The intent of the Opportunity Zone is to incentivize people with stocks and property to sell those assets and put them into communities to create jobs, housing, and other benefits. The tax on those new gains is deferred until 2026, when it must be paid, less a small amount, a 10% discount. The funds within an Opportunity Zone that have been put into the fund are then used for other projects across Oregon. Only if those invested in buildings or businesses are held for 10 years does the basis raise to market, and thus no capital gains are paid. That encourages long-term investment, long-term holding, long-term commitment to communities. As you heard earlier in the testimony of BC2 and Beaverton, the income tax, there's income tax to be earned from the 800 jobs that will be created in that project. Beaverton, which I also happen to represent, noted that project would generate $4.46 million per year in income tax revenues, let alone the property tax. Any capital gain foregone at the eventual sale will be a small fraction of the revenues generated by the investment year after year, not to mention the benefits of hundreds of jobs in a disadvantaged area and support for small emerging businesses and makerspace. But if a gain is never realized because the stocks or other assets aren't sold or invested in communities, there is no revenue upside to House Bill 4010. Yet the loss of investment in Oregon by Oregonians will be felt for years to come. Oregon investors know the state best and their communities, and they look to make a difference. Think about BC2 and Rockwood 10. Without opportunity zones, there might have been something built there eventually, but it would not have been these public benefit rich jobs and projects. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I urge your no vote on disconnecting the opportunity zone. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Mannix. I'm a Salem attorney and a former member of the Senate, former member of the House. And I appear tonight on behalf of Common Sense for Oregon, which is a nonprofit organization which has existed for 11 years and is engaged in evaluating public policy in terms of what we can do better, not what we can do worse. HB 4010, unfortunately, is what we can do worse. We are taking a federal policy, which we cannot change, and 86 zones which have already been established by designation by the governor, and then we're saying to the world, we want to be a second-class state to those investor organizations that are looking, where are we going to invest? We haven't talked about it enough from their perspective. Wait a minute. This is a state that's chosen to say that it doesn't like economic opportunity zones. What else does that tell us about whether or not the state wants us to come in from outside? We can also talk about people on the inside, but I'm talking about those national and international equity firms that are now looking at investing. And they're going to see Oregon as having just announced, if it passes this bill, that we don't like economic opportunity zones. That tells them there are probably other things that are going to come down that are going to be harmful to them. We also forget, although I've heard testimony tonight that clarifies, the loss of income that comes from these projects. The income tax that working people pay, the increased property taxes that these projects will generate in terms of local revenue. Now, take it down to the street level. We heard, I thought, very compellingly about the wide spot in the road. Monday and Tuesday of this week, I was in Coos Bay. I'd like to talk about the wide spot in the water and the roads that aren't there next to the water. There is an opportunity zone in Coos Bay, and that opportunity zone is near the ports, non-facilities. The opportunity exists for us to see investment in that very much distressed community. Now, if Oregon says to the world that we're second place for investment choices, I'm not talking about the person calling up a fund about whether or not I should put my money in the fund. I'm talking about the fund looking around at investment opportunities and shaving points as to where is the best place to go. And this bill announces to the world that we don't want to be in the first rank of investment opportunities. The other part of it that disturbs me is this is really at a retroactive effect as to people that are already investing in projects looking at what could happen. And that was most, to me, the most compelling testimony has to do with affordable housing. It's not just affordable for the occupant. It needs to be affordable for the investor. We should be doing everything we can to encourage people to invest in affordable housing so that people will be able to make use of that affordable housing. I ask you to consider these factors and then defer action other than perhaps a study of the impact of the special zone, the opportunity zone, and that's something that's worth discussing and looking at, but not acting on prematurely in this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we have a break? That concludes the public hearing requests to speak, but Representative Reschke, I don't think we have questions for this panel, so thank you.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Just to inform the committee, I do have an amendment coming that will just make this, take Section 6 and 7 of this bill and make it a study. And my point is we're hearing anecdotal evidence, but we don't know. And to change policy without knowing is, I think, dangerous. So I would rather know more about what's really happening in these zones, where the investment is really happening before we take any kind of action like this.
Thank you, Representative. Before I conclude our meeting, we're at ease for just a minute. This bill, is that correct? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 4010, and we'll stand at ease for a minute, but not related to House Bill 4010, but the committee is at ease. Okay, this committee is no longer at ease. We are still considering our work for the evening, I understand Representative Reschke wants to be recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Having served on the prevailing side, I serve notice of possible reconsideration of my vote on House Bill 4079.
Representative Reschke serves notice of possible reconsideration of his vote on House Bill 4079. That is noted. Thank you. The bill will be the first item on our next agenda. Okay, that completes our work for tonight.
Heck of a night.
Yeah. We're adjourned.
And my apologies.